Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
We're joined right now by a Super Bowl champion, a Pro Bowler, a 10-year NFL vet. He is a broadcaster. He is the founder of the Cliff Averill Family Foundation. We are going to get into all that. He is our first guest of the week. Cliff, my man, it's so good to see you. How are you?
I'm well. Just getting the day started, getting this whole Radio Row thing going. On the opposite side of what I'm used to being on.
All right, that's a great place to start. You are on the opposite side of what you're used to. What's it like being a part of the Row as a member of the media as opposed to being a member of, well, the NFL as a player?
It's a little different, but also, you know, I'm going to see a lot of guys that I know already, so the interviews will be a little easy, a little fun. You know, I'm here to enjoy it, get the experience, and hopefully build off of it.
Cliff Averill joining me on the Row. So as a player, what is this week like? As an example, you're coming off the championship game, and then you've got 2 weeks before the Super Bowl. What's the final week like? What are the players going through right now?
Oh, it's a headache. It's completely different from any other week of the NFL. You already got the game plan set, you know, so coming to the side, it's all media. It's, you know, family, dealing with family members. You know, you probably have 10 to 15 people there that you got to kind of cater to. Your days are just a lot longer. You know, it's just a headache. And by Wednesday, most guys are like, just, hey, let's get to the game already.
So, I mean, there's so much made about the experience that the Patriots have. I mean, 9 times. They've been through the drill. Is there an advantage for having gone through the whole thing, both on and off the field? Or does that experience not really matter?
I think it is for those that have actually experienced it. You know, the Patriots have a lot of turnover on their roster every year. But Tom Brady, Belichick, Gronk, those guys are consistent with it. So they know what to prepare themselves for. They kind of understand the process, and they can kind of hopefully bring the younger players along.
Cliff Averill joining us. All right, so one of the things you and I have talked about, when you look back at the Legion of Boom, part of what made it special, of course, was talent. I mean, these were some really gifted athletes. But you also make the point that guys were playing for each other. You hear that, but what does that mean exactly, and how does that show up on the field?
What that means for us was we actually liked each other. It was a brotherhood. It wasn't just coworkers. You know, most teams, you know, you're in the facility together, and that's what it is. Once you go home, everybody goes about their business. But it was different. You know, guys would go on vacations together. Guys, heck, to this day, we all still hang out and you know, try to find that annual trip that we try to take together because we genuinely liked each other. We genuinely wanted to play for each other. But not only that, though, like, I know Sherm's wife. I know Mike Bennett's wife. I know their kids. So that's what we mean when we're playing for each other. It's just it's deeper than just playing for that guy next to you. It's for their family as well.
So in other words, I mean, that's pretty profound in and of itself. In other words, not every NFL locker room is like that.
No. And it's hard to be like that, honestly. You know, and
you can't force that, right?
You can't force it. And then, again, with the turnover in the NFL, it's hard to build those relationships with each other. You know, you could have one guy. You're lucky if you have the same guy next to you for 3 years. In Seattle, we were fortunate enough to have guys, you know, be together for 5-6 years, you know, just how the contract situations played out, and that's not a common thing in the NFL.
I mean, is there any part of you that, because you know that, you know it's a business, and you know that guy that you're lining up with and going to work with every single day might not be there next year? Is that in the back of your mind, and does that kind of affect chemistry when you know deep down, hey, this guy might not be here, maybe I don't want to get that close?
It does, and that's one of the first things someone told me my rookie year, actually, was like, I don't make friends with anybody until the season's actually in, because I don't know if any of these guys are going to be here. And that tells me that even during the season, you're kind of, I don't want to get too close to this guy because I don't know when I'm going to be gone, when he's going to be gone. But, again, in Seattle, we were fortunate enough to know that, hey, these guys are going to be here because they're still on their rookie deals and they're playing outstanding ball. So it just happened organically.
Cliff Averill joins me on Radio Row. The other thing that's amazing to me about that group, you had some immense personalities, man. There were some really strong-willed guys. You could see where guys might knock heads, where they might not like each other. How do you explain that part of it? How does a group with so many really big personalities connect the way it did and have the chemistry you guys had?
I think the personalities are actually what kept us together, actually. You know, the perception of some of the guys, you know, being outspoken and loud and all these different things, but the other side of it is guys genuinely liked each other again. You know, Mike B would go out of his way to make sure everybody had lunch on Thursdays, or, you know, Sherm goes out of his way to come to all the foundation events or whatever, just different things like that throughout the locker room, I think is what made us all just connect on a different level.
Listen, Cliff, I don't want to bring up the sore subject. And, of course, whenever somebody says they don't want to bring up the sore subject, they want to bring up the sore subject.
Exactly.
You know, there was that Super Bowl against the Patriots. Yep. They included the Russell Wilson pick. You know where I'm going with that. I mean, losing that game has got to be excruciating enough.
Yeah.
Losing it like that has got to make it even worse if you feel like it cost you that game. In hindsight, did players stop trusting the coaching staff at all and maybe even each other? Like, what kind of an impact would something like that have on a locker room that we're talking about that was so good?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was with that whole situation, and obviously I've talked about this a few times.
You have.
Is that, yes, guys kind of question, start questioning basically the philosophy a little bit, but I don't think guys stop playing for each other, though. You know, I think guys still continue to want to play for each other. And again, it shows till this day, because we still all have great relationships with each other. But at that particular moment, yeah, everybody was ticked. Everybody was mad because they felt like, you know, they got robbed of a Super Bowl ring. Now, that being said, too, we all talk about this as well, is, hey, a lot of people talk about the one we didn't get, but we did get one. Now, let's not forget that piece, too, because we know multiple guys that play 10, 11, 12 years that never get to the Super Bowl, let alone win one.
So do you find yourself thinking about the one you won or the one that got away? What do you think about more often?
Well, I'm a Super Bowl champ, so I think about I think about the one
good.
I won. I'm one of those guys, hey, everything's half full.
You should. You absolutely should.
Exactly.
You know, something else you and I have talked about, week four of 2017, you had a really scary neck injury. Initially, you couldn't feel your arms, and then the feeling comes back. You thought it was just a stinger. Can you take me through the play? And as a guy who plays the game, like, how did you process that, and what were you thinking at the time?
I was scary. Initially, I didn't think the injury was as serious as it was. So going after making it a play that I've done numerous times, trying to swipe the quarterback's leg, just a perfect storm hits me in the chin and whatnot. Both arms kind of go numb. I'm thinking it's a stinger. Shake it off. Play next play, you go back in, you know. And then fortunately for Dr. Herring, shouts out to Dr. Herring and the Seahawks, he's like, no, this is a little more, it's deeper than that, you know. So let's go to the hospital. Go to the hospital, and the doctor asked me within a 30-minute span, hey, are you sure you're okay? Are you sure you're – and I'm looking at him like, bro, I'm good. Like, I want to catch the fourth quarter.
Are you not telling me something? Right.
Yeah, I'm like, I want to go play the fourth quarter. Like, I feel fine. And, I mean, he just kept asking, and then – probably after like the 10th time, he's, hey, the reason I keep asking is because most people don't walk in with this injury. They're paralyzed.
Wow.
And that's when it hit me like, whoa, you know, this thing is serious. And that's when I started like, you know, wondering, hey, will I ever play again? And through this whole process, and again, this is what I talk about with us being so close. Through this whole process, halftime rolls around, Mike Bennett's FaceTiming me. Sherm's texting me. These guys are checking in on me. It's like, hey, where you at? Like, we expected to see you in the locker room. You know, what's going on type of thing. And, it was definitely a scary situation once I heard that.
Cliff Averill joining us. That's a terrifying situation. What about this year? I mean, obviously, you're natural at this. You're getting to broadcasting. I knew you were going to do that. You're doing real well already.
Thank you.
What was that first year like without football?
Ah, it's different. It's different. And it's not necessarily even playing the game. It's the camaraderie. This is the piece people don't think about is, so I've been playing football for 16 years. I'm only 32, so half my life, right? Half my life I've been in a locker room with at least 50 to 100 guys. College is 100. So between 50 to 100 guys every single year for 16 years of your life, and then all that's taken away. Now it's just you, your wife, and your kids, you know? And that's the different part. That's the psychological piece that most people don't think about that kind of bothered me a little bit. But fortunately, I have a great relationship with the Seahawks, and I can go into the facility, and I can still go talk to Bobby, and I can be in the locker room. I can still get that fix of being around the fellas. But a lot of guys don't have that.
Listen, you have an amazing life. I mean, you really have an amazing life. That said, it's not the same, though, is it?
No, it's completely different.
It's not the same. When you're not there doing the work, and bleeding and sweating with these guys, and it's nobody's fault. It is what it is. You had a great career, but it's not the same.
No, it's not the same at all. It doesn't come close to being the same, you know. But I will say, I look at things a little different, is this could have happened year one of my career, you know. But this happened year 10, where I was fortunate enough to win a Super Bowl, go to the Pro Bowl, do all these different things. You know, it could have been worse. Like the doctor said, I could have been paralyzed.
I'm laughing because all of us do is think about what we don't have instead of the great things that we do have.
Exactly. Right. So I can't complain. It was a great, great ride.
And then off the field, Cliff, you and your foundation have done some amazing work in Haiti, which is where your parents emigrated from. Mm-hmm. It's something you and I have talked about also in the past. But before we get into it, for people who do not know, what is life like in Haiti? How would you describe life there?
Oh, wow. So it's two sides to it. Life in Haiti for a lot of people is, you know, poverty, don't have food, electricity, the simple things that we kind of sometimes take for granted. You got this huge building, right, with lights everywhere and water everywhere. That's not the case in Haiti. But there's another side to it, too, where this island is just such a beautiful place. Like, I'm looking for some land there now to build a beach house out there, actually, because it's that pretty. Like, the water is amazing. Most people don't even realize Haiti and the Dominican Republic is one island. It's just split down the middle, right? So, you know, just given that perspective of how beautiful it is, but yes, poverty and corruption and all these different things are happening there as well.
Make your tax refund go farther at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Do you need new wipers? A new battery? Maybe your tires are showing some wear and tear. How about your brakes? Do you need new filters? Are your fluids full? Think about all the things you've been waiting to fix. If you've been delaying some much-needed car maintenance, delay no longer. Spend a little of your tax refund on your vehicle right now and save on expensive repairs down the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts has exactly what you need at guaranteed low prices. From accessories, belts, fluids, hoses, two batteries, tires, lighting, and more. You'll even find parts for your own lawn and garden equipment. Spring is right around the corner. Get more out of your tax refund by checking O'ReillyAuto.com online for special deals, too. Save money on the projects you've been putting off at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Check it out. And we've got the head coach of Georgia Tech, Josh Pastner, joining me on Radio Row. Josh, it's so good to see you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Jim, are you going to come to the game tomorrow? I got two tickets for you if you want to come.
Okay, now we're talking. Good seats?
Good seats.
On the bench?
If you want to be on the bench, I'll put you right on the bench. I'll at least put you right behind us if worst case, to work.
I may take you up on that.
Yeah, let me know.
I've got some eligibility left. Can you get me the rock?
We need shooters.
Okay. And before I talk to you about that, and I want to hear all about the team, but how are you doing here? How is life at Georgia Tech?
Yeah, you know what? It's totally different than Memphis. You know, when I took over at Memphis, I was following John Calipari, and who had won 95% of his games, and I only got the job at Memphis because nobody wanted to follow John Calipari. They might want to follow me, but they don't want to follow Calipari. I was the last man standing that wanted that had a chance at the job. So, you know, I was there for 7 years. We had great success, and we had won about over 70% of our games. Usually when that happens, you get a statue built of you. But when you're following 95% winning percentage, you're like, what's wrong with you, coach? And so when I saw the Georgia Tech job open, I was like, that's a great job. It's in Atlanta, in the ACC. You have an opportunity to continue to build something. And there's other – it's not where the whole stress and focus is strictly on you. Where, like, Memphis basketball is very similar to Green Bay Packers or the New York Yankees in a 30 to 50-mile radius. So I thought, man, this is a great job. When that job opened, I was like, this is awesome. And they said, when I got the job, they said, we need someone who's ultra positive because we're going to have to, you know, have a chance to rebuild it back up. And it's going to take some time, but you're going to have to stay ultra positive through some tough times. And there could be a lot of losses. And I said, I'm the guy. I'm a positive guy. And I want the opportunity. That way I've seen it from both ends of the spectrum. And so I'm excited. There's so much good here in Atlanta. There's so much great in Georgia Tech. I mean, it's an unbelievable school. We got a tremendous athletic director, president. People talk about the academics. I'm like, it's awesome. Yeah, it's a hard school. But guess what? You really can be efficient recruiting because it's a smaller pool. Yes, you got to get those guys who are good enough to play in the ACC, which is an incredible league. This league is incredible. So you got to get guys who are good enough but can also handle the academics. And we got a lot to offer, obviously, here in Atlanta.
Josh Pastner joining us. He's the head coach of Georgia Tech. We're here to talk about Georgia Tech. One more thought about Memphis. I thought that was a really candid response and a really interesting answer. Knowing what you know now, would you do that again?
Absolutely. You know what? A few things. 7 years there, and here's how I took it. You know, for 7 years after every game, the amount of pressure to win was such a relief, because if you win, it was such a relief that I felt like I could actually go out the next day to a restaurant.
Wow. Was there no joy in winning, only relief?
Only strictly relief. Mm-hmm. And the thrill of victory towards the agony of defeat when we lost, because of the city, you were literally the mayor of the city. In that city, because how important basketball is. And there is, I mean, it is basketball.
And the mayor before you went on to be the president of the United States.
Yeah, I mean,
that's tough. Like, I mean, Josh, you are forever positive. You are relentlessly positive. You have an immense belief in yourself.
Yes.
You have to, right?
Of course.
Did people try to talk you out of it? Like, man, you do not want to do that.
Most people, people said, you're going to survive for 1 year there. And I told people, look, John, what he did in those 4 years will never be duplicated in the history of the game again. 95% winning, look, I remember one of my great years. We went undefeated in regular season. We went 18-0, and then we went 3-0 in the conference tournament. 21 wins. You know what people said? big deal. Calipari won 63 straight games.
Big deal. Cal does it every single year.
Yeah. So
you had to be like, are you kidding me?
It's an incredible place. It's the intensity, the passion. It is so intense. And here I am, 31 at the time. When I got the job, I was 31. And you know what? When you take over a multi-million dollar business, you usually have like a month to hang with the CEO. When you move over those 6 inches,
How far are those 6 inches? Talk about moving 6 inches. What's that like?
There is nothing you can. There is no blue book that can tell you what to do. How about I get criticized in my halftime interviews? I'm too upbeat. I'm too positive. This, that. I mean, what about?
Do you smile so much?
There you go.
What are you so happy about?
Hey, I haven't got enough technical fouls with the ref.
Don't you care?
And so everything is solely. It's so criticized and looked at. But I loved it. And I used to tell people all the time. I love being the head coach at Memphis because the intensity of the job, and you have to understand it and accept it and embrace it. And I understand in the smallest of all small scopes, when some of these people who are in such scrutiny in such an intense way, I get it because I was like that in 7 years for a 50-mile radius around the city.
Josh Pastner, joining us. I really appreciate your thoughts on that. So here, you go up against Duke the other night, and you gave them all they could handle now. You gave them all they could handle before they pulled away in the second half. Yep. Obviously, you want that win. But what did your guys show you in the way they went after it, especially on defense, and held Duke to 27 in the first half?
Well, Jim, let me just, first of all, this league is just, it's incredible. Think about it. We played Duke on Saturday. Well, guess what? 72 hours later, we're playing North Carolina. 72 hours later, we're at Florida State. Then we got to come back and play Clemson. I mean, it's just, there's no nights off. But let me tell you on Duke. Obviously, we played pretty well. We're a very good defensive team. In my 2.5 years here, we've been very good defensively. We're young this year. What hurt us, which is great for us in recruiting down the line, but we lost a kid, Josh Okogie, who went pro and with the 20th pick in the draft after his sophomore year. When you're rebuilding something, that's a hard thing to sustain, to lose a guy after your sophomore year when you weren't expecting it.
Right.
If you're at one of those other blue bloods and you lose them, you already know it coming in. We didn't expect that. That's 20 points a game in the ACC that we lost. You can't go get that in June. Hmm. Not at Georgia, when we're trying to build it up and you're fighting and scrapping and kicking and clawing to move up the ladder in this league. So anyway, well versus Duke. And I looking back at the film, you know what? Zion Williamson and R.J. Barrett, they're pros playing in college.
That's for sure.
So there was a couple plays where we were so good defensively, and they still scored on us. And I just told our guys, hey, those guys are pros playing in college, and there's nothing else we could do. Like Zion Williamson one time did like this, 40 feet away, did this to the point guard, to Trey Jones, and our guy is 6'10", and his hands up there, and Zion dunks the ball.
It didn't matter.
What are you going to do?
So what do you make of that? I mean, you've been around this game a long, long time. You've seen everything there is to see in this game. What do you make of what you saw from Zion?
Well, I think he is so quick. You know, of course I saw him a bunch in recruiting, but now seeing it up close, he is so quick off the floor. He is so explosive off the floor. He's literally like Charles Barkley, and he is powerful. His quickness, like the speed and quickness of his athleticism, he's not just an athlete. He is so fast. Like his quick twitch muscle fibers is incredible. And so he could play in the NFL or the NBA. Now, will there be both? Yeah, or both.
At the same time.
The question becomes, and I think R.J. Barrett's really good as well, a very good basketball player. You know, people are going to ask, well, how's Zion's skill set? Will that translate to the NBA? I think it's going to translate even more because of the rules. There's more, and it's offensive-minded. And he is so strong, I think. And plus with the marketing, whoever's the number one pick is picking Zion.
Josh Pastner joining us. You mentioned the conference. Now, the ACC, it's got four teams in the top 11 right now. The fact that it's tough is not a surprise to you. You knew what you were signing up for. But as you point out, you got Duke, you got North Carolina, Clemson's not too far down the road. How do you make sure that your guys learn from every game but are always focused on the next thing and don't get caught up?
Well, you know what, Jim? Here's what it is in this league. You know, when you're not in a league like the ACC, when you're playing like a Duke or Carolina, in this league, it's not like that because every time you step on the floor in this league, you're already playing someone so good. So you get used to it in a sense. And it's not such an eye-opening or a shocking situation. You just get used to it and you get comfortable with it. Now, what you recognize for us to build and get to where we want to get to, we have to get old and stay old. It's what Virginia's done. It's what like Notre Dame has done in the past. You've got to get old and stay old. We're not getting the one-and-done instant stud who's just going to come in and can carry us right to the promised land. We have to build through getting old and staying old. And that's why in this building process, it's going to be a 5 to possibly 6 years so we can get into the habit of just really getting old. It's the best way for us to have success in this league because the league is so deep. 15 teams.
Now, I've heard you talk about that before, mentioning Notre Dame and Virginia by name. Is that what you mean? You want to build a program that's similar to theirs?
Correct.
In that sense, that you can get old? Is that what you mean? And do the people who employ you understand that and will they have the same patience?
And our athletic director, well, Mike Babinski hired me, and I'm so thankful and grateful. And then Todd Stansbury has come in, and he's been so good to me. And he gets it. He's all about culture, and he calls it the secret sauce. And what he says on the secret sauce about is about culture. And at Georgia Tech, that's what it's about. We know what type of young man we can get, and you're going to have to build and develop, and then you've got to get to your juniors and seniors and continue that way. It's the best way for success because this league has 15 teams. I want to be able to get the one and done, but I recognize right now we're not beating Duke or Carolina on the recruiting trail right now for that kid. I get it. So we've got to be perfect in our evaluation, Jim, and we have to be perfect in our development. And then when our guys are juniors and they're 21 years old, we've got to be able to beat that 18, 19-year-old freshman at Carolina or Duke.
Can you see in the not-too-distant future, Josh, going into a living room where you know Duke has already been, North Carolina's already been, but you're going to be the guy to pull that kid out of that living room?
Yeah, well, in time. I mean, and that's where we have to get built to, and that's why, like, having the kid Josh Okogie go pro, even though it's great for Georgia Tech, it's great for Josh Okogie, it sucks for Georgia Tech this season.
Right.
We lose 20 points. You know, when you're trying to build, that's hard to sustain, to lose that. But what we can now go into a living room and say, hey, look, here we are. We've done this. Here's our platform. Here's a kid who wasn't a top 10 kid in the state, wasn't a top 100 player, didn't start in his AAU team. But through development, he's now in 2 years, he's a 20th pick, and he starts for the Timberwolves. So we here's a platform. Here's what we can do. If you give us a chance to even get your son, who's even a higher-rated kid coming on, we can now even build that into more. So that's what our part of ourselves.
Josh Pastner joining me for a few more moments. We're on Radio Row in Atlanta. Now, your story of your coaching journey really is amazing. You and I go way back.
We've
talked for a number of years. You were coaching AAU as a teenager.
Yep.
How much have the players changed during that time? Or maybe have they not changed that much at all?
I don't think they've changed. And you know what? Some of my great experiences was coaching, you know, those guys. And let me tell you why. Because I was around those guys who are high-level players. I understand it. I get players when I was at the University of Arizona, when I was at Memphis, here at Georgia Tech, in AAU ball. I get it. I understand on players. And so, yeah, things have changed here and there. Of course they have. But in the end, you know, players want to be pushed. They want to be coached. Sometimes people resist discipline and structure, but deep down inside they really want it. And on the other hand, I'll tell you what else. When you have some guys who can score, because I've always said this, you can't – culture, you can all be about defense and toughness and all, but offensively, you've got to have that ability, that innate ability to put the ball in the basket. And when you can get that guy that can do it, you've got to give him some freedom to be able to make some plays, because you can't box him in. It's like being a painter or an artist. You got to give him some freedom. And that's what basketball is, guys who can score the ball. And that's what I've said to our staff at Georgia Tech. We've got to keep finding that next guy who can just have innate ability to put the ball in the basket and can get you a bucket when you're struggling.
Some things you can't teach, right?
You can't teach.
Some things you cannot teach.
When you can score the ball, it's hard. It's just like James Harden. His ability to score.
What do you think when you watch him?
It's amazing. You see the moves that he's making. But he.
Just, I got to ask you, though. I'm sorry to interrupt, but so many people can't stand what they see from James Harden. Now, I don't get this at all, but this whole notion that, man, he cheats. He's always on the line. He's boring. This is tired. This is not good for the league. You've heard these things, right, about him? What's your reaction to it?
Well, you know what? And he doesn't get a lot of assists. Like, a lot of his made field goals are so low.
But he does, though. He's averaging, like, 8 a game.
No, but people giving him the ball, it's not a high.
No.
He's a dribble. But his scoring. And you know what? You know he wants to go left hand, you can't stop him.
You know it's coming.
But listen, it's not all. As much as he's probably worked his tail off in his whole life, he has been some God-given ability to be able to score that ball, and that innate ability. What he's doing is historic. And any of those guys at that level, when you can score, and that's why I say like R.J. Barrett versus Duke, he just has some things that either you have or you don't. He can score. Zion has that quickness off of his athleticism. You can sit in the weight room all your life. You and I could do the same workouts for the rest of our life.
We'll never be that guy.
No, he just has something gifted in him that he can do it, and that's why you got to appreciate some of those offensive skill guys that can score the ball like that.
Josh Pastner joining us live on Radio Row. It is so good to get caught up and talk some college basketball. I know you got a big one tomorrow night, so I really appreciate you and making some time. Josh, it is great to see you.
Are you coming to the game? Can I? I'll talk to you after the.
You haven't closed
segment.
Me yet, Coach.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm looking at a few other opportunities.
It's Carolina, Georgia Tech. You're right up the road, Jim. You're a basketball guy. We got to get you back. It's football right now, but we got to get you back in March Madness here.
Hey, check this out. I need to talk to you about a brand new product that I've been using, Aftershocks. They are the best-sounding, most innovative headphones that I have ever owned. Here's what's different about Aftershocks. They feature a patented bone conduction technology. The headphones do not go inside your ear like earbuds, which hurt, that are constantly falling out. Aftershocks rest gently just outside. That's right, outside your ear, and they produce sound by sending mini vibrations through your cheekbone to your inner ear by bypassing your eardrum. It sounds crazy. It works beautifully. Aftershocks features unbelievable comfort, music like you have never heard before, and crystal clear phone calls. And they're safer for driving in any outdoor activity because you have to hear what's going on around you, like the traffic and emergency vehicles. Aftershocks are perfect if you're outside running or biking, since you need to hear. It's a huge safety factor. And they're super comfortable, they're flexible, they're awesome sounding, and they're lightweight. I work out with mine every single day. I am never going back to regular headphones again. Aftershocks wireless open ear headphones are one of the coolest things I have ever seen. Order an Aftershocks tech bundle right now and get $50 off. Simply hit roam.aftershocks.com and use Roam at checkout. That's the word after and then SHOKZ.com. Roam.aftershocks.com. Jeff Collins is my guest. Jeff, I was saying, you and I were laughing during the break, you have to follow Pastner, but Pastner had to follow Calipari at Memphis.
Right.
Yeah, this is not easy.
Yeah, this is an honor to be on this show with you. I'm a huge fan, and this is kind of a surreal experience. I still remember when the Bills and the Cowboys played in the Super Bowl in Atlanta.
My man.
I was in college and came and experienced it. So to be on your show, it's a huge honor.
I absolutely love that you mentioned that. Do you remember that? Because I don't want to date myself, but I've been talking about it in the week leading up to it. I was here that week.
Right.
I covered the game that week. Man, it was cold. I mean, that ice storm was unlike any ice storm. What do you remember about that week?
Yeah, just being here and going through the NFL experience and, you know, being around the game. You know, I'm a huge college football fan, NFL fan, and to now be here, this is a surreal experience.
Hey, you want surreal. Jeff, what about the fact that you played in Bobby Dodd Stadium as a member of the Western Carolina Catamounts back in 89?
Yep.
Now, if I told you that day, after that game, that you would be here as head coach of Georgia Tech 30 years later, what would you have said?
Yeah, absolutely not. When I was a graduate assistant at Georgia Tech in the late 90s, early 2000s with George O'Leary, I kind of crystallized that I wanted to do this one day and be the head coach here. But still, you know, going around Atlanta, seeing my face up on the billboards around 285, it's still very surreal that this is happening. But I'm having an absolute blast doing it.
Jeff Collins is the head football coach at Georgia Tech. Now, you mentioned O'Leary. When you were a graduate assistant of his, and he was the head coach, you kept trying to convince him to let you recruit. Tell me about the conversations. What were they like, and what gave you confidence that you could go into somebody's living room and come back with a recruit?
Yeah, so I was a Division III coach. Albright College, we signed 82 kids. I signed 45 of them before I got my job at Georgia Tech. First year, I asked Coach O'Leary as a graduate assistant if I could recruit, and he just shushed me away and pushed me back in a corner to break down some more film. The next year, I asked him again, and he was like, all right, wise guy, you know, we have 6 primary states that we recruit. You can have the other 44. And, you know, he thought that would shut me up. But we signed 5 kids out of those 44 states, and the very next year he promoted me to full-time as the tight ends coach.
Yeah, it's probably similar to what I went through. When I worked at ESPN back in the day, I wanted to get one of those so-called Sunday night conversations, and they gave me the same thing, like, really, you want that? All right, here's 5 guys. If you can get any one of them, you can have that. But there were 5 guys that they could never get, so we went out there and we turned a few of them. How did you approach those 6 states when you got that opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. I just was relentless. GAs back then couldn't make phone calls, so I was just an incessant letter writer, and I'd probably send about 5 letters a day through the snail mail, and I got them to, you know, have interest in Georgia Tech, and we ended up getting them, signing them, and they had great careers for us.
We're talking Georgia Tech football. Now, as you talked about, when you were here, Georgia Tech was a top 10 team.
Yep.
They were playing for ACC championships. As you look at the work in front of you, What's it going to take to get back to that spot? Is it a total rebuild, or can you turn this thing around quicker than that?
Yeah, just a big thing with me is just culture and branding. You know, I've been here when Georgia Tech was in the forefront of the conversation in college football. College game day was here. You know, the primetime games are in Bobby Dodd Stadium. So I've seen it happen at this place, and I know we're going to get it back there. But it's all about culture. It's all about recruiting, and we're doing a great job. Hired an unbelievable staff of great men, relentless recruiters. They're going to help bring the talent back to the ATL.
The next head coach in any sport whatsoever that does not reference culture on this show will be the first.
Right.
I mean, culture is the buzz term, and understandably so. What does that mean to you? What does a Georgia Tech culture look like under Jeff Collins?
Yeah, innovative, playing with relentless effort, positive attitude, positive energy in every single thing that you do. We're going to attack everything that we have involved in the organization, and that starts with recruiting. That starts with our workouts. We were 5:30 Saturday morning doing a Game of Thrones workout in and around.
What is that?
It's just mayhem. There were 10 stations all over the campus, and for about an hour and a half, we got after it. Every single member of our staff, other than our full-time coaches, were dressed in as Game of Thrones characters, and just having fun, having excitement, working really, really hard, but you can have fun while you work hard, and we're doing that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because you made a point that having fun doesn't mean you don't care. Having fun doesn't mean you don't grind. Yep. And a lot of coaches seem to run from fun like it's the plague or something, and they treat college football like a job, you know, like a job or a career. And even worse than that, how do you go about balancing it out? Fun, but getting the work done.
Yeah, the big thing, I think you can have a lot of fun. There's a borderline between having fun, having energy, and having juice, and being silly. So we make sure we have that line set. We're going to do everything the right way, but we're going to have energy, we're going to have music, we're going to have, you know, just a lot of excitement surrounding our program, and I think the guys feed off of it. I mean, this is the music capital of the Southeast, actually the movie capital of the Southeast, so, you know, we're just going to have a lot of fun embracing that culture.
You mentioned juice. What does juice look like? What's it feel like? How does it show up?
You can just tell. It's people that have positive energy, excitement. When they walk into the facility, they walk into the building, you know, they want to be there. They want to excel. They want to work hard, but they want to positively affect their teammates. And the coaches that I've hired, I've been blessed to hire, have all of those traits, and I bring it out in their players. And, you know, so just getting to work together, we're doing that.
Georgia Tech head football coach Jeff Collins joins me on the row. Now, you talk about a guy who looks like he's not having a whole hell of a lot of fun. I could be wrong. Nick Saban does not look like he's having fun. You work for Nick. Is he having more fun than he lets on? And what was your biggest takeaway from being with him?
Yeah, I was blessed to be with him. 2007, we put together arguably one of the best recruiting classes in the history of the game, and learned so much structurally, organizationally, and how to deal with different parts of the organization. And, you know, I loved working for him. He coaches the defensive backs. I coach the defensive backs at Georgia Tech, and I did at Temple, and I take a lot of pride in that. I think the world of him.
Is he tough on the staff? Was he tough on you?
He is. It just, you know, holds everybody accountable. Everybody has an assignment. Everybody has a responsibility, and he does a remarkable job of just making sure, you know, that people are doing their job and following through in the mission of the organization.
Yeah, one more thought about him. He talks about the process. Well, he doesn't. Everybody talks about his process. Is his process so different from yours? Is it so different from other people's? I mean, is the process not attention to detail,
right?
Work really hard every single day? I mean, isn't that the process?
Yeah, so the beautiful thing, I've learned so much. I've been in with Dan Mullen at the University of Florida, at Mississippi State, and he had been with Urban Meyer. So that tree, I've been blessed to be in the Urban Meyer tree. I've been blessed to be in the Nick Saban tree and kind of blended those things. But the big thing is kids these days know if you're genuine or they know if you're fake. And so the big thing I do is try to be true to my personality, but still use the great things that I've learned from the great coaches that I've been able to work for.
What was the experience in Stark Vegas like? It's an amazing place, right?
It is. The cowbells, I think I still have echoes from the cowbells from being 4 years there. My last year there, we were number one in the country for 10 weeks. Dak Prescott was our quarterback. Bernard McKinney was the middle linebacker. We had a really good team and a really good culture. And the whole offseason conditioning program at Georgia Tech, and it was at Temple as well, is based on that offseason conditioning setup that we did.
How different a guy is Dak? What was he like to coach?
Yeah, so we have a saying in our organization, you can either be a great leader or you can be a great teammate. Those are the only two things you can be. But you can never be a great leader unless you're first a great teammate. Dak Prescott was one of the greatest teammates I've ever been around. first in the building, last one to leave, always ate last, make sure his guys were taken care of. And so it was an honor to be around him. We divide up the teams in the offseason in 10 different teams throughout the organization. The captains pick who's on their team, and one of my claims to fame is the last year there, I was Dak's first pick to be in the offseason teams, and we won the offseason.
That's great.
And so that was a little claim to fame for me.
That's a good one. Jeff Collins joining us. You know, you mentioned leadership. I'm fascinated by leadership. I'm sure you think about leadership quite a bit, have read up quite a bit on leadership. In terms of great leaders, are they made or are they born?
A little bit of both. I think you can, you know, work on your strengths, work on your weaknesses. We try to educate our guys every single day on what they need to either be a great leader, to be a great teammate. I do think there's an inherent quality to being an exceptional leader, but there are always things that you can improve on. I try to improve on them every single day, and we try to educate our leaders in that way as well.
Do you need to make a lot of great plays in order to be a great leader?
No, I don't think the playing has anything to do with it. I think that gives you a little more street cred at times. But some of the greatest leaders that I've been around are the role players. They're the guys that are, you know, in the trenches doing the dirty work. And I don't get a lot of recognition, but they're the ones that really set the tone for your program.
Can you be a great leader if you do not go to the Waffle House? My man, you are a legendary Waffle House practitioner.
There's no doubt.
When did that start?
So I've always been a Waffle House guy, ever since I was a little kid growing up in East Atlanta. And then being up in Philadelphia for the last 2 years, you had to drive an hour and 15 minutes to Delaware to go to a Waffle House, which I used to do.
And did you?
I did. There's even a YouTube video of us going and getting a cheesesteak omelet at the Waffle House in Wilmington, Delaware. But then I just came back to Atlanta, and I'd missed it so much. I think the first 9 days as the head coach at Georgia Tech, I was eating breakfast in the Waffle House. So
you have some catching up to do. Listen, I'm a West Coast guy, so I don't know a lot about it, and I think a lot of people listening or watching may not know about it. For those who have not had the pleasure of dining at a Waffle House, how would you describe the experience?
It's beautiful. You know, Anthony Bourdain and one of his shows, one of the greatest 3-minute segments in any of his shows was his experience at a Waffle House. So people go YouTube it, and it's just a great place. Just you feel at home. And the food is unbelievable.
So most importantly, is ending your day the perfect way to end your day at a Waffle House, or is it starting your day at the Waffle House?
100% starting your day. You know, I'm an early riser. I'm up 4:30, 4:45, and invariably I end up at one of those great establishments. You know, the yellow and the black and the Georgia Tech colors, you know, kind of speak to you a little bit.
Jim Trotter on the road. Jim, it is so good to see you. How are you?
Brother, I'm doing well, except you got me following Prisco, you know?
It's a tough act to follow.
You know?
I think you'll be all right. but that is a tough act to follow.
Pete did tell me it is a tough act to follow.
Oh, he let you know, right? Well,
yeah.
He's like me. He has not been giving himself enough credit lately, and nor have I. All right, so I mentioned Hall of Fame voting. Jim, let me start right there. Mm-hmm. You've got the Hall of Fame voting coming up later on this week. Overall, what is Super Bowl week like for you?
You know, Jim, actually, it's not too bad for me because I've learned over a couple decades of covering these how to maneuver to make the week easier for me. First of all, number one, I'm not a big party guy. I'm not a big crowd guy, so I don't have to worry about burning the candle at both ends. So that's good. Number two.
Let's not gloss over that, man. That is big.
No, that's
really big. I understand that.
Yeah, it's just not for me. So
yeah.
Number two, it depends on who I'm working for. When I was a newspaper reporter, man, you were grinding every day. You were doing a main story. You were doing a notebook, other things. So it was like you were just worn out by the end. When I got to Sports Illustrated, it was more of we're looking for one story, maybe two. So it was easier. You could prepare coming in, do some of that legwork before you got here. Then at ESPN, they didn't have me doing anything except for Hall of Fame. So it was like, why am I even here? In fact, no, true story. So there's 1 year we finished with the Hall of Fame. They don't have me scheduled for anything on Sunday. It was the Super Bowl down in Houston. I called my boss. I said, can I go home? And he seemed kind of surprised, but I said, there's nothing for me to do. I'm not just going to chase quotes after the game.
So, in other words, they were paying you
to do nothing.
I was going
to
say not to work that hard, but you're saying it, to do nothing.
To do nothing.
It's good work if you can get it. Jim, what's the problem?
I'm not wired that way, man.
Yeah, okay.
If I'm going to work, I want to earn my money. I want to earn my checks. So,
All right, I went home. Newspaper. SI, ESPN, pick up the story right there.
So now it's NFL Network, and there's something every day. So there's a couple of stories I'm working on, one on Ndamukong Suh, one on Brian Flores, the Patriots defensive coordinator, soon to be Miami Dolphins head coach, Then you've got TV responsibilities during the week as well, some radio row. And then on Saturday, which is, you know, a big day for me, it's the Hall of Fame voting. And that starts at 7 in the morning and goes until we get done.
All right, so what's your approach with the Ndamukong Suh piece without giving up what the piece is? I mean, I can remember when this guy came out of college and talking to him, and he seemed like one of those guys, well, if something seems too good to be true, it generally is. But remember how we all saw him then, and now consider how most people see him right now. And how about the fact that he didn't seem like he had a really good year, but all of a sudden reemerges when they need him most, right? So how are you approaching that piece?
It's more of just trying to get a little bit away from football, trying to understand sort of the psychology of where he's at in his life and his career. You know, what this moment means to him after all of the success in college, after being rookie defensive player of the year, after signing the largest defensive contract in NFL history and never having that team success, now to be at this point where you're playing for a championship, you know, what does that moment really mean to you? And particularly when you've sacrificed this year in terms of he could have gotten more money from a couple of different clubs prior to this season. He could have gotten greater individual accolade playing for different clubs. But you come in here and you sacrifice playing to, you know, the best defensive player in football, if not the best player in football, in Aaron Donald. So what is that all about, and has it been worth it?
Jim Trotter joining us. Now, you mentioned Prisco. Prisco said before he left he thinks that Tom Brady and Bill Belichick is the single greatest coach-player relationship in any sport, in the history of any sports. Now, you've covered this sport and sports in general for a long time. Have you ever seen anything like Belichick and Tom Brady and what they're doing in coming back for their ninth Super Bowl? Is it that big?
Well, not as it relates to the NFL, without question. I think when you start saying any sport, that gets dangerous. You know, you think of Phil Jackson and Michael Jordan. I mean, they went to six finals, never went to a game seven, won all six, you know, those sorts of things. So I'm not one to say all sports, but NFL, without question. Think about this. Tom has been in a Super Bowl in 9 of his 17 full seasons as a starter.
It's stupid.
Are you kidding me?
Right.
Since Bill Belichick came in as a defensive coordinator with the Giants, I think he's played in, I want to say, 32% of all Super Bowls since then, something like that. I know I'm not far off on that number, trying to do it off the top of my head. You look at this game, what's so interesting? Tom Brady has more playoff wins, more playoff passing yards, more game-winning drives than Jared Goff has in his entire career, including the postseason, regular season and postseason. So what they've done together and what Tom has done, and you know this, Jim, I grew up in the Bay Area, I was born in San Francisco. Joe Montana's always been my guy. You could never talk to me about a quarterback being greater than Joe Montana. Tom Brady is it. He is the GOAT, you know. And
you still feel that way if he loses?
Absolutely.
This Sunday.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Just to get to where he is at this point. And think about some of the losses in the Super Bowl. They took plays that none of us could have ever imagined, whether it's Tyree's catch or whether it's Eli dropping that pass into Manningham down the sideline. Phenomenal plays were required to beat him in a Super Bowl. So for me, without question, Tom Brady is the greatest.
Jim Trotter joining us. So Brady is the greatest. And Belichick is the GOAT when it comes to coaching.
Absolutely.
If you had to pick one, who deserves more of the credit for this dynasty?
You know, that's kind of like asking me cake or ice cream, you know? I'm going to say both.
No, that's easy, man. Ice cream.
No, it's both for me, man. I got that bad sweet tooth. But, you know, look, you don't want to disrespect the player and say that it's the coach, because you only win championships if you have great players. And you don't want to say disrespect the coach by saying it's the players, because there have been a lot of great players who didn't win championships in part because they didn't have the right coach. So I just think it's a perfect marriage between the two. I can't sit up here and say it's one or the other. I just think about what, for instance, but I do think about what Tom has been able to do with guys that are never going to be in the Hall of Fame with him. And I'm talking about from an offensive standpoint, not a defensive standpoint, but guys who are never going to be in the Hall of Fame with him. Guys with names that most of us would never know if not for Tom Brady. He is just a guy, and it's the definition of greatness to me when you elevate the play of those around you. He does it without question. He's phenomenal. I wish he would get off of the whole, you know, somehow being disrespected or whatever, even now X number of years into the league. But that's who he is. That's part of his edge, you know?
That's his fuel. Nobody's buying that. I don't know who the, quote, people are who say they suck. Right. I don't know who these people are who he says don't believe in him. You know, but maybe in part, Jimmy, answer my next question. When you talked about Tom Brady elevating guys' play around them, I mean, based on everything you've seen, everything you've reported over the years, how do you explain what the Patriots have done and how they're able to do it? And how come nobody can copy them or emulate that or stop it?
Well, I think, number one, you're talking about an all-time great player and an all-time great coach. That's number one. Then you look at the staff. I think one of the things that Bill Belichick does so well is he coaches up his coaches. A lot of head coaches can't do that in terms of their assistants being able to coach what they want, how they want it, to their players and relay that information. Bill's very good at that. Why can't anyone emulate it? There aren't very many Tom Brady's or Bill Belichick's around. And then it's getting the right players. The one thing I've always respected about Bill, Bill never bought into the whole resumes in terms of all pros or Pro Bowls. He says, I need specific players to do specific things. I don't care about what your resume is. I just need you to do this one thing and do it well. And that's what he asks of you. He does not ask you to do well things that you don't do well. And to me, that's a sign of a great coach.
Jim Trotter joining us. Jim, back to something Prisco said. We were talking about Todd Gurley and the fact that he had that terrible game against the Saints, and they still found a way to get it done, which to me speaks to the Rams' toughness. They're more than just this high-octane, high-flying offense. That's a tough-minded team.
Sure.
Prisco said he talked to some folks, some scouts, who suggested anonymously that Gurley may have shut it down, that the moment may have been too big. I have no idea what it was. I'm assuming he's not right physically. How do you explain that guy having that game on that big of a stage? Do you have an opinion on it?
Well, I can't, other than say that I know this about Sean McVay. I'd heard going into that game, he was not the kind of coach who was going to be influenced by, again, a player's resume and past accomplishments. He knew that C.J. Anderson was running really well and had played well while Todd was injured and hurting. And the one thing Sean was going to do was to make sure that he had a role for C.J. in that game, regardless of how Todd felt about it or anyone else, and he did do that. Does that get in Todd's head? Possibly. I mean, if you're a great player, you want to be on the field in those moments. But to his credit, he said afterwards that he sucked, you know, that he did not play well, and he didn't. And I don't expect him to have two of those back-to-back.
All right, so back to the point about the Rams and their physical toughness. I mean, are they a run-first team? Or are they a pass-first team?
No, I think everything stems off their run game, their play-action pass game, without question. You know, you could talk to people during the year, even early in the year, where Goff was putting up numbers and whatnot in the passing game, and everyone who has been around that team or close to it will tell you that Gurley was the straw that stirred that drink. They go, for the most part, as their running game goes. And look, you know this, Jim. In this league, if you can make a team one-dimensional, it's that much easier to stop them. And I can guarantee you right now that Bill Belichick and Brian Flores are saying, we have to shut down this run game. When I talked to the Saints prior to that game, NFC Championship game, to Dennis Allen, he said, the first thing we've got to do is slow Todd Gurley and C.J. Anderson. And that was their focal point.
We're talking to Jim Trotter for a few more moments. Jim, the Patriots got on this season's playoff run with that dominating win against the Chargers. I had Anthony Lynn on Friday, and he was very straightforward in saying, we picked a bad day to have our worst day. Where do the Chargers go from here?
Look, what they've got to do, number one, offensively, is get some folks who can win one-on-one battles, more guys who can win one-on-one battles. I think they understand that to beat teams like the Patriots, particularly when they go into man coverage, press coverage, you've got to win those battles, and they didn't. So I think with them now, look, there's no question the Chargers have talent. But, I mean, anyone who would say they don't, they're kidding themselves. But I do think in that game, they got out-coached, they got out-schemed, they got out-game-planned. They simply were not ready for what the Patriots brought to that game.
Guys, you have heard me talking about this for weeks, and some of you are still on the sidelines. Whether you're an expert or a rookie, you should be betting at MyBookie. If you're the kind of guy that likes to bet a little and win a lot, like playing the numbers on roulette, then you can create a big parlay. Pick three teams to win, and if you hit all three, you could turn $100 into $600. There is so much to bet on. Football, NBA, NHL custom props, even esports, you name it. MyBookie is the one bet that I know you'll be happy with all year long. I recommend these guys because I trust these guys. MyBookie has been in business for years. They've got great online reviews, and their mobile site is easy to use. Sign up this week, and MyBookie will give you a 50% deposit bonus to jumpstart your your bankroll. It's a great way to bank even more money when you win. Do not miss out on one of the best weeks to bet on sports this year. Log on to MyBookie right now and use the promo code Rome, and you'll get a 50% deposit bonus. Once again, promo code Rome. You play, you win, you get paid. You know I'm talking about Pete Prisco. Pete, good to see you. How are you?
What's up, Romy? How are you?
Good, man. How about you? How's your week going?
I'm good. You know, we're right over there in our studio, in our CBS Sports HQ studio over there all week.
How do you like that? How's that going?
I love it.
It looks great, by the way.
It's fun. They've done a great job. It's 24 hours on Hulu, Apple, the whole deal. You can find My Ugly Mug on there.
Don't let anybody on that network. So lay it out. What do you do for them? And if people looking for you want to see you, when and how do they find you?
It's, you know, like a 24-hour sports network that's on Hulu and Apple. It's all the cord cutters. I'm an old man, so I'm not a cord cutter, so I don't know what that is.
I was going to say, do you even know what that means?
You should hear my dad trying to find it. That's even funnier. No, it's great because we do a lot of, you know, with Brady Quinn and Brian McFadden, we do a lot of, you know, their shows and preview shows, and we do a preview show with Brady Quinn and myself every week. We break down the games, and we don't hold back, by the way.
No, you guys don't. You don't. I watch it. I think it looks great. There's some really good information that comes out of that every single time. Now, you do a lot of – part of the reason for that, but you do a lot of work on games, after games. You watch a lot of film. You analyze everything. You tend to know what works and what doesn't work. How much film of the Pro Bowl did you break down?
None. And you know what? I was actually flying up, and it was on. I was on JetBlue, and I'm sitting there, do I really want to watch this? It was awful. That game has to go away. Now they're putting guys in other positions. You know, when they start goofing around and somebody gets hurt, then you're going to have a problem.
That's the thing, right? I mean, that's the biggest issue with it, because guys are there to have fun. Guys are there not to get hurt, and as long as nobody gets hurt, they'll keep doing it. They'll keep doing it because people watch it. For some reason, people do watch it. My point is, you can't kill that thing. You can't fix it. But you cannot kill it.
You're right. You can't kill it. But can you do something like make it a flag football game or something? People would still probably watch it, right? But somebody could get hurt in a flag football game, too. Remember Robert Edwards back in the day got hurt
on the beach.
In the sand. Yep. In the sand, yeah. So you got to be careful no matter what you do.
Juju Smith-Schuster got dinged. And you imagine the horror the Steelers must feel watching that and seeing the potential number one. In fact, let me skip to the bottom. Right? What about that? Antonio Brown, are these differences irreconcilable? Is there any way you see him returning to Pittsburgh?
No, I don't. Now, you know, you never say never, but it's bad. I mean, it's a bad situation. And you talk to people around the league and they say it's even worse than what it was. So I don't know how you fix that. And it's not just him either. Ben Roethlisberger's at fault, too. And so is Mike Tomlin for allowing it to happen. But I don't know how you fix it. But who trades for him, though?
I was going to say, realistically, what's the market for him? And what can they realistically expect to get in exchange?
They're not getting a one for him. They can talk all they want. Now, people say the Raiders have those extra draft picks they could give up. I don't see that happening. I don't think the Raiders are going to do that. He's 31. He'll be 31. I mean, that you're starting to talk about a 31-year-old receiver who makes a lot of money. Yes, he's still a darn good player, but is he worth the headache? Everybody, you have to balance the headache against how good a player he is.
Can I say something? When you have the year that he had, 15 touchdowns, over 1,000 yards receiving once again, about 1,200 yards, if you're not worth it, man, you're a big headache at this point. Those are big numbers.
And
he might not be.
I think, too, Romy, I think he's bothered a little by Smith-Schuster starting to take away some of his targets.
You know it.
And he might end up being the number one guy. And you know the passing of the torch. Guys hate that.
No. Pete Prisco joining us. That would not go well. I can't see him saying, you know what, I'm going to step aside because it's your time, young gun. That's not the way he's wired.
No.
That's not the way most of those guys are wired. All right, so before the conference games, Pete, you called your shot. You predicted the Patriots and the Rams. Let me start with the Rams. What did you see in them that made you feel like they could go on the road and beat New Orleans in New Orleans?
You know, the reason I picked them in that game, it didn't happen. I thought they would run the ball.
Mm.
I thought that the offensive line would push the Saints around a little bit. Even though the Saints were pretty good against the run all year, I thought they would run the ball. But then we saw Gurley standing on the sidelines, and it's one of the great mysteries of the NFL season so far.
Yeah, what happened? What do you think happened? Because we know he was hurt late, but he came back, he played well against the Cowboys, and then he was nowhere to be found in that game. What happened to him?
You know, I was in Mobile last week for the Senior Bowl, and there were some scouts and personnel people were wandering around. Did he check out of the game? Was it too big of a moment for him?
Wow.
And that's, I mean, for me,
was
that would
really
be
the talk? Were people saying that?
Yeah, that would be crazy, wouldn't it? That would be absolutely crazy if that were the case.
Do you think there's anything to that?
No, but there's something to it. Something's up. It wasn't an injury. And they've come out and said it. And privately, they've said there wasn't an injury. So why was he standing on the sidelines? Why was he seemingly okay standing on the sidelines? That's the problem for me.
Yeah, I want to say because he's hurt. because he's not right, and they knew he wasn't right, and he knew he wasn't right, and they got him out of the game. But you think that he might be right. He might be fine physically.
If he's fine physically, it's a problem.
I was going to say it's a real problem if he's fine physically.
Right.
I'm assuming that there's no way that guy would mentally check out and that the moment would be too big for him. Now, maybe I'm wrong. He does not strike me as being that guy. But if that's the issue, can they win without a guy who's fully engaged and right?
Absolutely not. As good as C.J. Anderson's been, they have to get Todd Gurley in this game to have a chance to win. Here's the other thing, Romy. If I would say he was hurt and we'd say, okay, he's fine. But he came back against the Cowboys and ran for over 100 yards. And then he practiced all week and they said he was fine all week. So where's the injury? Did it happen on a Saturday before the game? I mean, what happened? Did something happen?
No, I made that same point. He did look really good against the Cowboys. But if that moment wasn't too big for him, why was the next moment too big for
him? Don't know. And I don't think that's not my theory.
Reportedly.
Allegedly. That's not my theory. I'm just something I'm repeating. But I don't know. There's got to be something else at play here.
Pete Briscoe joining us. You know, with all the focus on the blown call in the championship game, are people forgetting that the Rams did come from way back? They were down 13-0 in that first half. Are they getting credit for being as gritty and as tough as they are?
You know, it's funny because Gurley might have wilted in the moment, but Jared Goff did not. And there were people around the league who thought he would be the one that would be the one that would have the trouble in crunch time. And he played great football in the fourth quarter and in overtime. You got to give him credit. So you got to give the Rams credit. You know, it's funny. Zuerlein nailed a 57-yard field goal, could have been good from 70, and nobody talked about it in a pressure situation because of the blown call. Forget it. The blown call's gone. There's nothing you can do about it. It was a terrible call. It was one of many. Hey, they blew a face mask on Jared Goff late in the game. That would have been a first and goal. They would have scored a touchdown anyways.
I'm going to argue Jared Goff played better than Drew Brees in that game. He played great. How do you think, though, he shows up on the biggest stage on Sunday?
I think he'll be fine. You've talked to him before. He's got a little bit of a swagger about him. I mean, he believes in himself. He kind of shrugged off all the critics anyways. He bounced back and had the great season last year, and then came back, had another good season. I think he'll be fine. But everything they do, they have to run the football. Everything they do is predicated on that outside zone. And you know who runs the outside zone? That's Todd Gurley.
All right, so they got to run the ball. Can they stop the run?
That's going to be a problem. And everybody, you know, we talk about Aaron Donald. Aaron Donald's a great player. Defensive player of the year. He got my vote. He'll be named that on Saturday. But one thing you can do at Aaron Donald is run at him. He's not a big physical guy. I imagine the Patriots are going to line up just like they did against the Chiefs and pound it against the middle of that defense.
Pete Prisco joining me here on the set for Radio Row. You know, for years, you always hear defensive players say, if you're going to have any chance against Tom Brady, you got to pressure him right up the middle. You got to get up the middle. They've got Aaron Donald. They've got Ndamukong Suh, who suddenly looks more engaged than he did the entire season. Do you think they can get the pressure on Brady that they need to disrupt him and his rhythm?
If they stop the run. If they don't stop the run, they have no chance. And the problem is with the Rams, they're little. You know, Donald's not a big guy. The linebackers are very little. Mark Barron's a converted safety. And so I think knowing Bill the way I've covered him and watched him over the years, I think he's going to line up and power football against them.
All right, so if you're Wade Phillips, what is your top priority on Sunday?
Stop the run.
Yep.
If you stop the run, then those guys can get after Brady right up the middle, and that's when you give him problems. We've seen Brady over the years. What has this kryptonite been? Four-man rushes that get him off the spot. We've seen it in Super Bowls. We've seen it in big games. We saw it in the championship game against the Broncos that one year. I think they have to pressure him up the middle.
Now, Pete, speaking of Belichick, when you look at him, how many people, literally, who've ever coached in this league would be able to get what he's gotten from this particular group of players?
This is one of his best coaching jobs, if not the best. And people will say, well, the first one, that team wasn't that good. Remember, in the middle of the season or early in the season, people were burying this team. They were burying Brady. They were saying they're done. The dynasty's over with. You can't ever bury him because the defense always gets better at the end of the year. He takes young, undrafted guys like Jackson and puts them in the lineup, and they start making plays, and he takes cast-offs like Simon, and he plays. That's what he does. He's a great – this is just proof of how great a coach he is. And the question is this now. Is this the best coach-player combination in the history of sports?
Huh. Where'd he come out? Answer your own question.
I'd say they're in the argument as number one. I mean, people will say Jackson and Jordan, you know, Russell and Arbach, and, you know, but they're in the conversation.
And yet it almost ripped apart. Allegedly.
Right.
Reportedly, right?
Right.
Huh. All right, so what about, okay, you're talking about guys, that he can take guys who are just guys and turn them into stars and make them really effective. Julian Edelman is an example. Not a guy, but a star. Not just a star, but all of a sudden you're hearing
JLC,
that he might be
Jason,
Hall of Fame
up?
Material.
You should list that first,
do you buy that?
I think.
He's not
that
good.
Like career accomplishments.
No,
I think that should come first.
I did not in any way want
to
disrespect
shift that
you.
Order.
If it's okay with you, I'm going
to
take you up on that.
Okay, from here on
by
out.
By the way, as impressed as I am with your life and your resume, that's the most important thing to me. First
Likewise.
Ever guest.
Likewise.
Likewise.
They'll never take that away from us.
They can't. They cannot.
No.
They cannot. Over my dead body, man. That's a reason to go now.
That's right.
All right, so you made the point that when it comes to the Patriots dynasty, outside of Belichick and Brady, there has not been a lot of roster continuity, right?
Yeah.
So when you look back at how much this team has changed and evolved from the time when they were a physical running team with a great defense to where they are right now, where they don't have much of a defense, to Randy Moss, to Gronk, what kind of thoughts do you have when you look at that evolution?
I think it just speaks to the greatness of Bill Belichick, and it speaks to his ability to coach any position, to coach any scenario, to coach any type of athlete, to convert defensive backs to wide receivers, convert quarterbacks to wide receivers, convert linebackers to pass-catching fullbacks, to do whatever needs to be done to maximize the assets available to them vis-a-vis the warts and the deficits and the holes on that other roster, and it can be things changing from a macro level from season to season, like power running team, then the two tight ends, then the deep threat, you know, changing from vertical to horizontal, or it could just be shape shifting in the moment. For this half of football, we need to go and do some stuff we haven't worked on since, you know, the first week of training camp in July, but I'm going to expect everybody to be able to call back on that and now put it to use. And there's no substitute for intellect, I guess is what I'm saying. He likes smart players. He is super smart. He demands a lot of out of them, and he can figure out pretty early on who can do what and what can I do with them to win. And it's like he's playing chess and other people are playing checkers.
Well, and being smart helps. You have to add that, but it won't. It's not the difference between being a really effective player and not. Like, how do they do this? Like, look at Brady. Outside of, say, Randy Moss and Gronk, it's not like he's throwing to a bunch of Hall of Famers. If anything, it's a bunch of seventh-rounders. How in the world has Brady, and by extension Belichick, had the success that they've had throwing the ball to the guys they throw it to?
It's astonishing. And I think you have to lump Josh McDaniels in there as well. Tom Brady is obviously incredible. He's the GOAT. He's the greatest football player I've ever seen. I think he'll go down as the greatest football player of all time. But the guy helping pull the strings and the guy knowing what pieces to put where and the guy developing the offense and creating what they need to do that week to win, I think there's a lot of brain power and continuity in that as well, and the trust that these three men have in each other to be able to go at each other's throats sometime, to challenge each other in a way that probably others would shrink from, but they understand as part of their dynamic, and to bring the best out of them. It's amazing. I mean, I remember sitting running the numbers before last year's Super Bowl. Oh, who are the 10 guys who caught the most balls from Tom Brady? Like, Ben Watson was still on that list.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like,
wow.
David Givens and David Patton didn't make the top 10, but, like, they were in the top 15. You know, Kevin Falk was still fifth. You know, like, he's throwing to Edelman and Welker, guys nobody else wanted. He's throwing to third down
Where
backs.
Was Troy Brown?
he was in the top 10, I believe. I mean, like, Brandon Lloyd was, like, 20th. I mean, Brandon Lloyd was there for, like, a minute.
Right.
I mean, like, Dante Stallworth was, like, in the top 20. I mean, and then, you know, you look at Peyton Manning, and it's Marvin Harrison and Reggie Wayne and Edgerrin James and, you know, Marshall Faulk. It's a little bit different. I think that they hold themselves to such a high level, you know, the what they're willing to let slide versus what other organizations are willing to let slide, or, you know, who makes the cut with them. If you make the cut with them, they see something in you that they're going to, again, I'll go back to it. They're not going to ask these guys to do more than they can do. They're going to figure out the exact things they can do in that moment to help them win, and they'll feed them when they need to be fed.
Jason Lockenfora joining us on the row. Go back to what you said about McDaniels for a minute. I mean, obviously him leaving Indy at the altar and the way he did was not a good look. It was probably not a good thing, but I don't know that people really thought that would ultimately hinder him from getting another job. There were some really good jobs that opened up that went to some really young coaches with high side potential. Why is McDaniels, why did he not get any of those?
You know, look.
Because they'd wait, right, if they thought he was worth it.
Yes, they would. They're waiting for Flores. They're waiting
right.
for Zach Taylor. I think there was really only two that were going to appeal to him. Well, I know there were only two that were going to appeal to him. Cleveland and Green Bay. Green Bay, if you look at the history of Green Bay, from the moment Vince Lombardi walked in that building, only twice in the history of that organization have they hired a quote-unquote retread, a guy who's been a head coach somewhere else. They don't do it. The last time was Ray Rhodes in 99. That was a one-and-done. The only time before that was Forrest Gregg, who was a Hall of Fame player and a Hall of Fame offensive line coach for them before he went and coached the Bengals and, I think, the Browns. So it never really fit their model. They ended up hiring LaFleur, somebody incredibly malleable, you know, younger, never done it before, who they can bleed into their culture. Josh has a lot of that Patriots way already in him. The other one he would have taken if they offered to him was Cleveland. Twice he said to Jimmy Haslam, no thanks, I don't want to interview for your job. Now Jimmy Haslam is no longer sort of the broken down person in the corner. He's now the best looking girl at the bar, right? Now everybody wants his job. Well, you know what, Josh? We're not coming to you this time, buddy. I think it was a personal dynamic there where Jimmy Haslam felt like I was spurned by him twice before when I needed him to help build me up. Now that I'm on the cusp, I'm not going down that well.
If Aaron Rodgers had gone to management and said, I want Josh McDaniels, would he be the coach there?
I'm still not sure that would have carried the day at the end of the day. I think when you look at what they did there, and it's Mark Murphy really very much, he's the owner in every way, shape, and form now. He is flexing his muscles and exerting his ability to pull the strings in the same way an owner would, except he doesn't have, you know, he didn't have to pay, you know, $2.5 billion for the team or anything like that. But he's putting a model together that he thinks works for him, and personalities and people at parts of their career arcs are very similar in who he's putting around him. It's young, ascending people who they think they can mold into a cohesive unit where, I guess, the collective is more important than any individual. I never got the sense they were going big. I think their feeling is, we're paying this quarterback $36 million a year. We don't need to pay a coach $10 million to run him, right? We should be able to get a guy for five. This quarterback's so good, and win that way. They're going to pay Mike McCarthy $9 million to watch games on his couch this year. I don't think they were going in the deep end of the pool.
Jason Lockenfora joining me on Radio Row. Now, you had a great piece, I thought, a great piece on CBSSports.com last week about gambling in the NFL. The league has been very careful. It's been very cautious about embracing sports gambling. But based on your reporting, how interested is the league and the teams in gambling, and what steps have they taken to move in that direction?
The owners are incredibly interested, and I've had numerous people who've worked on this in the league office tell me that they see gambling as the potentially second biggest revenue stream league-wide, behind only the TV contracts. And we already know there's billions per year tied up in that. Well, the people are throwing the B word around in regards to what all the ancillary gambling revenue could be at a team level and a league level once sort of the shackles are off and we're full bore and there's an official gambling house of the NFL, and the NFL, whether they sell next-gen stats to somebody else to use for gambling purposes or to set lines or for fantasy football or whatever, there is a new horizon out there, and these owners have dollar signs in their eyes, and they're meeting every Friday, having conference calls with the league internal people, figuring out when the technology is right, when we feel like the real-time stats are airtight, right? We can't say Justin Houston got that sack on Sunday and then come back on Tuesday and say, no, it's a half sack, and some, you know, like that. The payouts are already made, and once the league's in bed with these guys, you can't have that going back. So that, they feel like they're getting there from a technological standpoint. They're going to continue trying different models, experimenting with what they think works the best. And this spring league, the AAFL or the AAL, I get them confused.
Right.
This is the one launching right after the Super Bowl. They're going to use that as a gambling incubator, an IT technology incubator, to help them gauge which of these processes work the best, so that if it's week one, maybe it's week one where they launch full bore and start really folding gambling into the mainstream of what NFL content looks like.
I mean, what types of legal sports gambling are we talking about? During games? Are we talking about bets that are placed, like the ones that are being placed right now? Or are we talking about micro bets, not only within the game, but play to play to play?
I think all of the above. I think we could also be talking with the next gen stats, who ran the fastest route today, who caught the highest, you know, who high pointed the ball at its highest point, who threw a touchdown pass with the greatest velocity. I mean, whether there's a market for that as a gambling item in and of itself, or whether that information would be worth a ton of money to Ladbrokes or William Hill or somebody else to help use to set their lines or set their prop bets or whatever else, There's gold in them there hills, Jim, and they're chipping away at it.
Hey, listen, one more thought about that. I mean, you thought there was outrage over the no call in the Rams-Saints game. How about the outrage over a call that's blown like that that impacts lots and lots of bettors who are on the wrong side of a wrong call? How concerned is the NFL about that?
No, absolutely, and that's why as much as these owners on a literally weekly basis want updates on where we stand, where we're going, you know, who we're going to try out, who we would take bids on, you know, all that stuff. They know that at the end of the day, when they put their name to it, when they are involved in taking money directly from whoever their official sponsors are in the gambling realm, that everything has to look completely above board, has to be completely above board. And there's processes and vetting and things that have to go on until they get there. But that's where it's going. It's just a matter of, you know, if. Not one.
Way too much money involved. All right, before I let you go, how about a quick thought on the matchup itself? Assuming that the Patriots' offensive line keys on Aaron Donald and Ndamukong Suh, how does L.A. respond? What does their defense need to do to have success against Brady?
I wonder how much New England just keeps doing what they're doing, which is this old-school throwback football they're playing with. We're gonna keep you heavy. We're gonna make you get out of your base and adjust to us. We're going to hit you with the fullback. We're going to hit you with Dwayne Allen. We're going to hit you with Gronk. And we're going to run at your ends. We're going to run at Dante Fowler and see how he holds up. Because Joey Bosa didn't hold up that well. You know, and Dee Ford and Justin Houston, especially in the first half of that game, didn't hold up so well. And I wonder if they run away from the interior of that line, make those guys move laterally to help out the ends, to help out the outside linebackers in the run game, and try to keep them going laterally instead of collapsing the pocket. And if they come out that way and you have to adjust any manpower additionally to the box against Tom Brady, he's going to find, like Marcus Peters, whoever, he's going to find the matchup and he's going to destroy some poor corner with the Rams. I'm fascinated by the approach Josh will take with the run game, and I think they're very happy with this throwback style they've adopted. And they've got multiple backs there who can beat you. And you go back to the Saints game, every time Alvin Kamara went wide, it was joy. 8 yards, 12 yards, 13 yards, wheel routes, little screens, flares. Those linebackers couldn't cover
him. They don't have that. The Pats don't have anybody like him, but do they need somebody like him?
Well, I think White's close enough.
Right.
I mean, you can throw the ball to James White 20 times in a Super Bowl.
For sure.
I think we've seen that before, and I don't know which linebacker is going to keep pace with him. I don't know that Mark Barron, you know, a safety/linebacker, is going to keep pace with him. You can shoot Burkhead out that way. I think it could be a keep it simple, stupid approach from the Patriots that might be very effective.
And then finally, what about Sean McVay? What do you expect to see in the matchup between the Rams' offense and the Patriots' defense?
I expect to see a lot of Todd Gurley. There has to be a lot of Todd Gurley. I think they realize that they've got to run. They're going to have to run that offense through him and then force New England to make adjustments off of it. I think he catches a ball the first play of the game. I think they force feed him early, get his confidence going, and let New England know that this isn't going to be easy for you. Again, we're talking about these teams and their offense and all the points they've scored. I think it's going to be matching wits in the run game and who makes what adjustments and where those weaknesses are. I don't think the Rams can win this game unless Todd Gurley touches the ball upwards of 30 times, honestly. Because he's going to be – him in the screen game, that's a problem for the Patriots. Aren't overloaded with speed guys. I think little passes, airbacks, guys coming off the edge in space, catching little 3-4 yard passes, turning them into big gains, could be a problem for both teams.
You know, he picked a bad day to have a bad game. Luckily for him and them, it didn't matter. What do you think happened to him against the Saints? Just a bad night or something else?
I think it was a combination of factors, Jim. I think it was rust. I think it was a little bit of conditioning and all the time he missed and being, you know, when he had 400 touches in the first 8 weeks, you had the wear and tear plus the knee, plus them riding the hot hand. Plus, he had a crisis of confidence. I mean, I think they felt like, boy, if he can't catch a screen pass without it turning into a misadventure, and we've got this other guy that's safer, and we're just trying to kind of stay in this game, we're just going to stick with that. But we saw Sean McVay rebuild Jared Goff over an offseason from year one to year two, and not just as a football player, but sort of as a man, as an athlete, just from a confidence level. He's got 2 weeks now to get Gurley going again. He wasn't going to take, you know, time away from coaching that game to go sit there with Gurley and preach to him. But he's got 2 weeks between that game and this one. And I think he will reinstill in him, bro, there's nobody better than you. Like, we're going to feed you. You're our guy. Forget about that game. I think he'll get him mentally where he needs to be.
JLC doing JLC things. What does the rest of your day look like?
A lot of TV here on the CBS Sports Network. I'd be lying if I said I know exactly what all the shows are called. Yet I haven't done them yet, but I know we're on until midnight.
I just know they can't do them without me.
No, no, I didn't say that. I'm glad. I'm happy to do my little piece
I'm
in each of
it.
Them. But,
yep.
Yeah, we're on live here from Atlanta until midnight all week long. And, yeah, blink and you'll miss me.
Bill Romanowski. Romo, it is so good to see you.
I tell you what,
look like $1 million, man.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, Jim.
What am I drinking today?
You're drinking the Lean One smoothie at Smoothie King. No added sugar, no artificial anything, and lose up to a pound of body fat a day with the Lean One smoothie.
Are you kidding? If I drink 10 of these today, can I drop 10 pounds in one day?
Well, maybe 2 to 3 pounds.
I also said, okay, and when I said, Romo, if I've got a cold right now, I mean, nobody cares. I'm not saying that to say that. But if I want to get better fast, do I work out more or do I work out less with a cold?
Yeah, you sweat a cold, rest a fever. So absolutely, you work out and you take 20 grams of vitamin C.
20 grams.
20 grams.
All right, man.
If you can get it IV, do 100.
Damn, I was just going to say
100 grams.
I was just going to say, do I shoot it directly into my system?
Absolutely.
Or do I slam a few? Hey, where do I get an IV, Romo? I'm not wired for that stuff like you are.
Well, what we would need is a naturopath or someone, you know, an osteopath,
a
naturopath.
A pusher.
A vitamin C. Absolutely.
You know, I did it once. It didn't do a damn thing. I almost had a bag of that stuff. I'm like, man, this is going to go. In fact, it was before another Super Bowl where I felt something coming on. And what is that? Why do you always get sick before a Super Bowl? I sat with an IV of vitamin C for like an hour?
Yeah,
longer?
That sounds right.
It didn't do jack.
But you know what?
Did not do jack.
But here's the problem. Most doctors, naturopaths, osteopaths, will not do more than 20 grams. I believe in you go big or go home. And I go 80 to 100 grams when I do a vitamin C IV.
I up your 100. I'll do 250. Romo, I'm not saying this because you're here, but already one-third of the Smoothie King is gone, and I already feel better than I did after that whole IV drip of vitamin C.
Absolutely.
Again, what are you putting in these things?
Hey, this is 20.
It's all legal,
hey,
right?
This is Lean One, 20 grams of protein, 17 fruit and vegetable extract, 10 grams of fiber. You go to Smoothie King for the Lean One smoothie, lose up to a pound of body fat a day. See, I already see it. You're already leaner.
Right before your eyes. Romo, shoot me straight, and don't take it the wrong way. Are there steroids in here?
Are there
roids in here?
No, there are not.
It's all natural, right?
This is all natural.
We got too far down the road. I meant to start by saying, Romo, how the hell are you? I think I know the answer already. How are you? How are you feeling?
You know, I feel really good, Jim. Running Nutrition 53, you know, that's what I do day in and day out. I do Raider stuff on the side, which I love. I love the Raiders, and I eat, breathe. But I tell you what, this last year was kind of hard and difficult for me, being a Raider fan and helping them out when it comes to doing radio and TV. So that part of it was real difficult.
All right, so what about that? What was it like for you to watch that team and what happened to that team both on and off the field? What was this past year like for you?
Well, I think what John Gruden did is he dismantled it, and now it's time for him to build it back up. And if you're a John Gruden fan, and I am, I love John Gruden. Back when he was our offensive coordinator in Philly, Jim, he was the only one to call me when I left there. And I went to the Denver Broncos. And you know what he said? He called me, he said, these dumb SOBs don't know what they're doing. You're the only guy I would keep, you know? And that made me feel good. And then I went to Denver and won 2 Super Bowls. So Denver,
and that made you feel better. And that made you feel even better.
Real good.
All right, so what about like the second, like Gruden 2.0? Do you like what you see from him? I mean, in other words, has the game passed him by, or has he kept up with the game, and is he the right guy at the right time?
The game has not passed him by, okay? He had to make some real difficult decisions. If you believe in John Gruden, you believe in his vision, you know this. He's got the opportunity to create a dynasty, but he has got to hit it not 100, but he's got to be up in that 85 to 90% on the draft picks.
All right, so he's got Mike Mayock, who's dominating the draft for so long.
Yep.
What do you think about that hire? Does that make sense to you?
You know what? At first, I was like, wow, that is way out of the box. But when you look back, when I start evaluating, I'm like, you know what? Mayock's a BC guy. I'm a BC guy. So I got to stick up for that. And he knows talent. Now he's got to learn business, and he's got to learn being what it's like to be a general manager. I think he's going to focus on his strength. His strength right now, Jim, is going to be really geared towards helping John find talented college football players to draft. That's going to be his initial strength. So, hey, what has he got? He's got 3 first-round draft picks and 2 second-rounders. So that's going to come in key. They got to pick up 2 to 3 free agents, and they got to hit it out of the park there, too. They've got $100 million to spend, and they better spend it right.
Bill Romanowski joining us. The Raiders will ultimately end up in Vegas. We know this much. You know, Romo, this is the 20th anniversary of your Super Bowl win with the Broncos over the Falcons. I've been telling the story. I was here that week. I remember how cold it was, man. It was crazy how cold it was that week. You had won it all the previous year. How hard is it to get back to the Super Bowl in 2 straight years?
Oh, my Lord. You know, I've been back-to-back twice in my career. My first 2 years in San Francisco, it's funny. I was like, okay, you get drafted and you win Super Bowls. This is easy. Well, it doesn't work that way. You know, it took me 8 years to get back with the Denver Broncos. And what you realize is after you win the Super Bowl once, everybody is gunning for you. You get everybody's best shot. And if you handle it and you handle it right, it makes you better. And that's the situation. I think the New England thing, I tell you what, I've never been so impressed. I get more impressed every day. But it's really this. It's the coaching. It's how they get better at the end of the year.
Right. Now, they always say that you can't choose when to peak. They clearly are peaking when they had to peak.
Yes.
And when they wanted to, right? They set it up like that.
Yes. And you know what? I look at it this way. And there's one thing about Bill Belichick that I love. It's the attention to detail. It's sweeping the corners of the room. Nobody sweeps the corners in the NFL. Bill Belichick sweeps the corners. He dusts off, you know, the light, you know, the little light plugins. He dusts off everything. He sweeps everything. There's nothing that gets past him.
Bill Romanowski joining me on the set. Romo making his triumphant return with Slamming Protein, and we're doing it live. Now, Romo, back to 20 years ago, that was the week, of course, and I thought of it this morning when I woke up, when safety Eugene Robinson was arrested for soliciting sex the night before the game. I mean, keep in mind, this guy was like an NFL Man of the Year. He was unbelievable.
Yes.
Unbelievable. And while we may not know all these guys or any of these guys, it still was the most bizarre thing ever. What was your reaction? As somebody who played in that game, what was your reaction when you heard that before the game? Did you know that had happened?
Yes. I come down to brunch, and believe it or not, I think I was talking to Shannon Sharp.
Huh.
And Shannon was the one that shared it with me. And I was like, you know what? We just won. I said that to myself.
Why? What made you think so?
Because I know what that kind of distraction does. And I learned that kind of distraction a few years later when I got to Oakland. And we had the Barrett Robbins thing happen. Because you know what? There was a terrible feeling in my gut, Jim, when that happened, because on Saturday before the Super Bowl, when I was an Oakland Raider, we were talking about Barrett Robbins, and we were talking about what was going on. Is he going to play? What's going on? You know what we should have been talking about? Kicking Tampa Bay's ass.
Right.
And we weren't.
What was that conversation like? What were you guys talking about, and what kind of an impact did that have on the team?
You know, it was a distraction. And those kind of distractions really, and it's, hey, at this point, you're talking about decimal points. You know, you're talking about very little if it will make a big effect at the biggest time, the biggest game on planet Earth, and that's the Super Bowl. And, you know, so you get the Eugene Robinson thing happen. I knew we were in a good place, but then it happened to my team, and I knew we were in trouble.
You know, that defense that you had, the one we're talking about that was here, man, you had some guys who could bring the heat. You had some guys who could bring the lumber, Steve Atwater. But at the same time, there was a feeling that maybe you guys weren't getting the respect that you deserved coming into that game. You got after Chris Chandler. You sacked him. You forced 4 turnovers overall. What do you remember about that day defensively?
You know, what hey, the key to that was early in the game. You know, we had a fire blitz on. I was able to get a sack on him. And I tell you what, I hit him so effing hard, I don't know how he got up. And when I mean I hit him hard, to his core, I felt like I could have broke his spine. I hit him so hard. And the fact that he got
what
up.
What did you think when he got up?
I was like, you know, I don't know. This guy's going to be a pile of crap the rest of the day. Okay, that's what I said to myself. Because you just don't know what I brought in that hit. I swear to you.
Was he a pile of crap the rest of the day? I mean, can you see a point in any game if you hit a guy like that and you lay a hit on him, that can you see how that manifests itself? Or that guy's not right. He hasn't been right since that hit. The entire tenor of the day changed with that hit.
We played, you know, we had a big rivalry when I was in Denver, and it was against the Oakland Raiders. And it was when John Gruden was there and the quarterback. If you knew how many times I hit Rich Gannon like that, because our game plan was to blitz him and blitz him hard, I hit him a couple times. And I remember when I got to Oakland and he pulled me aside and he said, Romo, you have no idea how much I hated playing against you. You hit me a couple times where I didn't know if I could get up. And somehow, some way, my teammates got me up, but it was just plain will that got me through the game. And when you get that good hit on somebody, you know, because it feels so good. It feels good to you.
I was going to say, Romo, I was waiting for you to finish that. What does it feel like to put a hit like that on somebody? Is that like, does it feel like nothing at all? Does it feel like you're tearing paper? What's it feel like to you delivering that hit?
You know, it's like, you hear at the bottom of the pile, and, yeah, I don't care who it is, you can just hear it, you know? And then,
after all these years, Roman, you still scare the hell out of me, man.
And then when they get up,
yeah,
you're like, okay, I got to give them some respect, okay? But I'll tell you this, I'm coming harder next time, because somehow, some way, you know, I'm going to try to get him out of the game. Because literally, that was what I tried to do. Every time I hit someone, I wanted to knock them out of the game. I didn't want to hurt them permanently. I wanted to hurt them bad enough to where they couldn't play in the game I was playing in. Because I knew their backup was probably not as good as them.
Clearly, because he's a backup.
Yeah.
Could you or anybody else play the game that way today, given how it's officiated? Could you have that same mindset?
Yeah, I probably would have been kicked out of every game if I played the way I played, because I was a head hitter. I hit with my head. I delivered with my helmet. My helmet was a weapon, and it was the best weapon I had, and I used it. And from the time I was 10 years old, I was taught to hit with my head.
Right.
And I remember there was a time in Denver when I was getting fined almost every week. Back then, we're talking late 90s.
Sure.
And I was the most fine guy in the NFL. So Mike Shanahan called me up to his office. He said, Bill, I just got to let you know, I got word from the NFL. If you get fined one more time, they're going to suspend you. So that was on a Monday. I had just gotten fined. And that tormented me till Saturday of the next week.
Right.
It was in my head, Jim, because I was like, you know, I had a streak going. I really was going after, you know, never missing a game. And I was able to accomplish that. But we get to that Saturday. I was like, F it. I don't give a crap. I am going, and I'm going harder than I've ever gone before. I'm going to deliver blows with my head.
You mean like every other day of your life, Romo, of your entire life.
Good night!